Oi, oi, it's your boy, the Makwan Amakani of Racking Up Punani, Jack Slack. It's the Jack Slack Boycast, and I stole that introduction from Coding Badly on Reddit. And if he's not a boy, he won't know, so don't tell him. We're coming at you ahead of UFC 268. I know you're thinking, what? It was literally just UFC 267. And before that, it was like 2 months before, since UFC 266. Yeah, for some reason, back to back, they're pulling a double shift, and I have been beaten down by 3 weeks of Norma Dumont main events to the point that I'm willing to accept it. Picard is good, top to bottom, looking banging, and we're gonna get right into it. So what I've just been doing today was I was rewatching Usman versus Covington 1, because that's our main event, Usman versus Covington 2. And, it was a lot of fun, like I remember. And, we got the grudge match, the grudge rematch. And, you know, a lot of the time I'm like, oh, really? Rematch already? But at this point, like, there's not really any more sensible matchup for either of these two. Because Usman, you know, after the Covington fight, he took Masvidal, Burns, and then Masvidal again. You know, the second Masvidal fight completely unnecessary, and the Gilbert Burns fight was almost short notice anyway. A lot of it was put together during like the early weeks of the pandemic. The Gilbert Burns fight was basically decided on because he beat Tyron Woodley. Meanwhile, in the meantime, Colby Covington has basically only fought Tyron Woodley, who was, I think that was his third or fourth in a row. How many was that? Yeah, that was his third in a row, and that was his 15th round loss in a row when he submitted to rib injury in the fifth. You know, it's crazy because I was, having watched the Usman Covington fight, I had a hankering to watch that clip of Mama Woodley and Usman basically going to tears on her shoulder because she's like, doesn't matter, it's your time now. I was watching that, and there was a clip of them discussing it on the Rogan podcast, Rogan and Usman, and they both get teary talking about it, which is so sweet. But that was just after the fight, and Rogan's going on about how he thought, like, he'd been saying that Woodley was in the running for the greatest welterweight of all time. And you're going, Jesus, that's not aged well. And, I mean, Tyron Woodley's, like, career hasn't aged well. Very, very dangerous fighter back in his day, but, like, just because of the way that he's gone out, you know, now losing a fight to Jake Paul in the boxing ring and then getting a tattoo to try and get the rematch. And the best part is that he got the tattoo, but he got I, Jake Paul. And then he wrote love in Sharpie so that later he can be like, fucked Jake Paul or whatever. He's like, no, it's still pretty lame to get a tattoo, you know, for someone who beat you just because they said they might give you the rematch and they're never gonna. But anyway, back to Covington and Usman, their first fight. And how I think this fight's... Well, actually, let's talk about this because I thought... this was sort of like the start of Usman coming into his own from both southpaw and orthodox with the jab. Really nice stuff. But I thought that Colby Covington, his game plan was awful. And, you know, fair enough. You're like, oh, we're going to have a grudge match. I'm going to go in there and bang. But his coaches were also awful between rounds, which is very weird because they're, you know, it's American top team. Conan Silvera was his main cornerman. And they're saying things like, right, you need to go hard, 5 more minutes and stuff like that. And it, like, no content behind it, which is weird because, you know, if you watch Mike Brown or Dean Thomas in the corner, they typically have specific advice, even if it's things like, we need combinations, Tyron, which you've never thrown in your life. But it's especially weird because every time Usman switched to southpaw, he was opening up the calf kick. And the calf kick is a great kick because, one, it cripples people very quickly. And two, it comes in below the knee. So it's a lot harder to run in on a takedown off it. So you can throw it against good wrestlers and not have the same outcome as if you throw like a thigh kick or a body kick, which, you know, Covington was throwing throughout this fight. And Usman himself is a guy who is publicly known to have shit knees. His knees are falling apart. And to never attack his leg. Like Covington threw one low kick in the entire fight by my count. And that was when Usman went back to orthodox. It was an inside shin kick. And you're like, that doesn't do anything. What was the point of that? But Usman's a guy like Dominic Cruz, where if you look at it with any sort of measure of sense, you know, just approach it as a logical problem. The guy needs his legs to move around on, and his knees aren't in great shape. You should probably be working towards kicking in your game plan, low kicking. And everyone got transfixed by Dominic Cruz's head. Prior to Henry Cejudo, no one was using low kicks well against Dominic Cruz. But yeah, Covington threw no low kicks the entire fight. Basically, he was doing fine from orthodox in the early going, and that's probably because he sees a lot of orthodox fighters. You know, that's who he's going to be training against most of the time. And then Usman started switching between the two, did a lot of good work from southpaw, and then he went back towards orthodox near the end after he'd already broken Covington's jaw and had really beaten him up with the jab and body shots too. But really, every time he switched, Covington should have been like feigning punches at the head or just throwing like punches that he didn't really need to land at the head and then slamming in the calf kick. And the other thing is that, like, specifically against jabbers, because they like to adopt a long stance to shoot in with the jab. If you watch Usman fight, generally his stance is very long anyway, with like very low degree of bend in the legs, which is another thing about his knee issues. Like, he stunned, might have been Covington actually, but he stunned some guy, and there's a great gif of him like trying to chase across the ring and he can't because his knees are locked up. And he looks like a big scary spider. It's really weird. But yeah, you need to extend into your stance the jab like Usman does, and that is, you know, the perfect time to counter with the calf kick. You know, maybe the inside slip and calf kick. Maybe if the distance is right, you just slide back and calf kick. But the counter calf kick is the jab killer. But there was one kick below the waist attempted in that entire fight by Colby Covington. So yeah, not great game planning, not great cornering. Obviously, the wrestling didn't really come into it at all, aside from the end where Covington tried to stick his head between Usman's legs to do the, is that an Iranian where you lift them? But I don't think his intention was to lift him. I think he was just trying to stick his head between Usman's legs so that Usman couldn't hit him. And if you watch the finish, like, Usman's not landing good blows to finish the fight. Whatever on the stoppage, but like, it wasn't. I thought Covington was doing a decent job of trying to hide his head and stay away from further punishment. Probably recapture some of his senses. But aside from that, the wrestling barely factored. For Usman, the stuff that worked was obviously the jab off both stances. Probably more so off southpaw in the early going until Covington got more hittable as the fight progressed. But the southpaw jab was a good shout because obviously Covington's going to have to deal with less southpaws. And a lot of southpaws don't have a good jab because they get into that Covington role of lead hand fighting and then throwing combinations or kicks or whatever. The front kick to the body was a great shout by Usman. If you watched, like, Covington himself loves a body kick and a head kick, but the way that Covington uses the head kick is like a round kick, obviously, to the head off his left leg, and then he level changes immediately afterwards. So if you watch, like, the Lawler fight or the Woodley fight, I mean, both guys were basically dead on their feet, but the RDA fight, you know, anytime he goes up and down and then changes levels and takes someone down, there's often a high kick in there. It's a great way to stand a guy up, because he's going to be braced taking the kick. You're going to be lifting him up into his stance and then you drop on his hips. But the body kick, you know, the round kick to the body is another one that Covington throws to pair up with that high kick. And it very rarely lands on the body. And if you watch, any of Usman's fights, but like the Usman fight against Burns and the Usman fight against Masvidal, he does a very good job of, if you throw a body kick at him, he takes it on the forearms and the other hand comes across and scoops behind the kick and starts parrying it across his body to start coming in with either like a takedown attempt or to follow up with striking of his own. Same parry that Masvidal used on Cerrone, of course. But more than that, like, taking a kick on the arm, not ideal if you're fighting like Yodson Clyde. They will just kick you in the arm until your arm breaks, or just to like lift you out of stance and score points basically on the pretty kick and how you reacted. You know, a lot of people, if you kick them in the forearm or wrist really well, they sort of stumble. But in MMA, you know, if you throw a round kick and it just to the body, you know, and the guy's arms aren't out of position, you're just going to hit his arm. And then, you know, more likely than not, he's going to chase you back with something, whether that be a takedown attempt or a punch or whatever. Whereas Usman was having great success with front kicks to the body off his rear leg, which, you know, front kicks to the body are killing it in MMA right now, whether it's a snap kick or a push kick, doesn't really matter. It's the same line. It comes straight up the center. It's the jab of the legs. Who was it? Duke Rivers, he used to call it a leg jab. The leg jab. Doesn't take a lot of talent to kick someone in the leg. It's the longest, straightest blow of the lower body, except for low-line sidekicks. And it conveniently targets a body part that's quite hard to target with your hand. Dipping down for a body jab, you know, you do sort of expose yourself a little bit to counters. So front kicks to the body, great shout. You know, the problem is you're on one leg, but you're keeping the guy out at such a distance. You know, on a round kick to the body versus a front kick to the body. Round kick to the body, your knee comes up and the guy can step inside your knee, which is how 90% of people who get countered on round kicks get countered. On a front kick to the body, your knee's in the way and your foot's in the way. And it's kind of like how on the calf kick in McGregor Poirier 2, Poirier's throwing the calf kick. If you throw a thigh kick, it'll ride up. If you throw a calf kick, the guy has to reach down and pull it up. And the distance was greater, so Poirier's foot was always in, his foot and knee always ended up in between him and McGregor, which is stuff you can fight off. If the guy steps down inside your knee, you've got issues. So the front kick, much better generally. I think everyone should be using the front kick, abusing it. And Usman did in that fight really well. The interesting thing was the front kick probably got more weight behind it because it's if you're throwing your weight onto it, you're on one leg, you're throwing your whole weight through your foot. It's a leg, so it's heavier. But the way that body shots tend to work is that it's an attritive effect. And the ones that double people over tend to be the ones where they've been caught breathing in or they just didn't expect it. So a lot of Usman's best hurting blows to the body in that fight were right uppercuts to the body from Orthodox, which he kept catching because when Covington came in, he'd try and grab the collar tie behind the head and then hit him with the uppercut to the body. Winded him really bad in round one and round four, I think it was. But on the subject of the collar tie, he grabbed the double collar tie in round one, and I really liked Covington's defense, which, you know, defending the double collar tie, or the tie plum, as we used to call it back in the day, before we knew that plum was just the word for clinch generally in tie. The break to the double collar tie typically are, you know, you put your hand across them, you cross face them, and you turn your shoulders. If you watch Nick Diaz against Paul Daly and lots of people, he'd let them grab the double collar tie, put an arm across their throat, turn his shoulders to strip the collar tie and then come back hitting the body. There's other ones where Fedor used to doing the same sort of thing, he'd grab behind their head and then use his shoulder. But generally it's stretching out the arms and turning the shoulders to pop them off. But Covington, when he was double collar tied by Usman in the first round, he reaches directly up like he's combing his hair, you know, elbow going upwards alongside his head. And he gets his fingers over the top of Usman's fingers. So if you imagine doing a finger-to-finger grip or a skeleton grip or an S grip, go look that up on Google Images. But if you imagine doing that, but with the other guy's hand, so he just peels all four fingers at the same time. And if you're holding four fingers at the same time, that's legal in most grappling sports. It's only when you start peeling one finger away from the others, or two, you know, or even three. But, you know, if you get all the fingers, it's legal. So I was really enjoying that, him just reaching up and peeling it down. And it was very similar to what Rick Glenn was doing on the bottom of side control the other day, clearing the crossface by peeling the hand at the fingers. But most of that fight was just voluminous punching by both men. I mean, the jab was getting off from Usman, but then if Covington hung around and threw more punches afterwards, he could often catch Usman on the return. It was, you know, Usman was doing the better sharp shooting and hitting one at a time, and Covington was doing better in combinations, but it wasn't like he was landing all the combinations. He was landing the third punch on the end of a combination. So he ended up probably landing less overall. And it was like neither wanted to test the other's wrestling. You know, it was basically the good outcome to the classic grappler versus grappler dilemma in MMA, where you normally just end up with a shit kickboxing match. Chet Kongo fought another kickboxer back when he was starting out in MMA. I think it was Ivel, because they were both massive black dudes. But they just rolled around on the floor trying to heel hook each other. They didn't do anything to do with the kickboxing part. But yeah, we're doing this fight again. I'd say Colby Covington, kick the fucking legs. I mean, it's going to be tougher when it's Southpaw versus Orthodox, because you don't want to be kicking inside the leg. It's not as useful. And step-up calf kicks are quite tricky. You know, watch Arnold Allen. Step-up low kick Jerome Labana style, go high on the leg, but then you're risking the wrestling. But every time he turns southpaw, you should be punting his fucking leg. Every time he's jabbing from southpaw, you should be punting his fucking leg. You know, making him, there's two things that can happen. You injure him as he keeps going for it. And then you've got a less mobile target, a guy who's going to have less or more trouble stopping your takedown attempts if you want to go to them, or he's going to stop throwing jabs from southpaw, which takes away 50% of your problem. And then back to orthodox, you know, yeah, he was doing all right from orthodox last time. His right hook was catching Usman a lot, but he was still struggling with the jab an awful lot. So, yeah, I'd be very interested to see if they've got anything to take that away. I liked his left straight to the body from southpaw versus orthodox. Bodywork more generally, you know, effective bodywork, because that's the difference. Like, the difference is summed up by that, by his body kick versus Usman's. Usman's was poking in regularly, maybe not as powerful, but poking in. And Covington's was slamming into the forearm every time. And then he'd throw like a knee or something stepping out afterwards. Like, the pace is not an issue. Colby Covington can go, you know, he was getting hit in the body and still went for four and a bit rounds, throwing high kicks the entire time. It's a case of picking better shots, not throwing four or five strikes at air to land a you know, a sixth. Whereas Usman, you know, accuracy has been his stock and trade recently. So more of that. I'll be very interested to see if they do go to the wrestling and try and test it. You've got to think Covington has an advantage on the level change. But if he gets into the fence, you know, Usman's very, very strong, and you don't want to get turned around and just held to the fence and hit with short right hands to the body. Yeah, I think it's one of those ones where, like, the first fight was clearly a grudge fight. This one's supposed to be a grudge match. They're billing it as a grudge match, but you have to go away and be like, yeah, no, we did well in the first fight, both of us, but Usman clearly fought smarter. Usman didn't come for, like, a, we're going to throw haymakers at you. Well, I mean, he was throwing good punches, but he wasn't there to just, like, take his head off with every blow. He was jabbing. He was kicking the body. He was trying to pull him onto body shots as he came forward. Covington was just there going, like, I'm going to land more punches to the head every time we come together. But clearly the two best guys in the world. So I'm quite excited for that. And we might get to see Ali Abdulaziz being a dickhead again. I was watching the last fight, and the moment that they go and still and raise Usman's hand, Ali Abdulaziz marches in from behind everyone else in a suit over an orange turtleneck and banging his chest, walking right up to Usman, like deliberately in the camera shot immediately behind Usman. And then there's a great clip. Go find Hectic One on Twitter. If you're big in the MMA meme space, he's your guy. But there is a shot, you know, when they do those like pose for photos afterwards, like with your team or whatever, or your family. There's an amazing shot of Ali Abdulaziz standing in front of Usman and his entire team and family, and directly in front of his mother, just blocking her out of the shot. It's basically, you know, it's Ali Abdulaziz to a T, you know. He's the UFC's controlled opposition, basically. You know, he's supposed to be there going like, I will get you the best deal out of the UFC, and the UFC are just letting him. You don't even need the weird sort of semi-racist angle that a lot of people take when they don't like Ali Abdulaziz, which is pointing out that he was a informant for the FBI or the CIA. It was one or the other for like terror plots or something like that. It was all very sketchy. Something to do with like a passport for the Olympics on the Egyptian judo team, which he was never on. It's well sketchy, but like, you don't even need to, just focus on his actions managing fighters. That's sketchy enough. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how deep to get into that sort of rematch, because the first match was just them banging. But if you like fights with people banging, then be excited for this one. However, you know, I've seen enough rematches of bangers to know that there's also a good chance of both guys going like, I'm going to be well tactical this time, and then it just being a humping along the fence extravaganza. But expect Chimaev to be front row for this one, because they're going to try and set up him versus the winner, I imagine. Actually, if Colby wins, they probably have to do a third with Kamaru, but we'll see. Right, what else is on this card? Well, rematch of Rose Namajunas versus Weili Zhang. Where Kamaru Usman versus Colby Covington was like 25 minutes, you got to see these guys testing each other. The original Namajunas versus Zhang was like the best part of a minute. Yeah, 1 minute 18. It was very interesting, because I remember doing stuff before that and going, yeah, she's an interesting matchup because of her movement and stuff. It's going to be very hard for Weili Zhang to time that inside low kick, and she'll throw herself out of position and stuff. And everyone was like, no, Weili Zhang's just unstoppable now because of two good fights back to back. But I don't know if that fight told us much, because it was just a little high kick, you know, little step up high kick, the kind of kick that gets thrown away a dozen times about, you know. And it just happened to catch her behind the hand, you know, and she got sent down and finished. I don't know if that's representative of every fight between them, but it'd be very interesting. I mean, you know, Namba Yunus has a great jab and comes in from a good distance, bounces in really well. So the setup is there for that high kick, especially if she can get Zhang reaching. You know, Zhang does tend to reach for punches. I think this is, yeah, we're going to, if you're Zhang, you've got to play the part of the bully, and I don't know how good she is at that. Like, I've seen her overpower Jessica Andrade. I've seen her, you know, just out-punch Joanne and Jacek and win exchanges that way. But that's, you know, that's a willing partner you're engaging and just timing. Whereas Rose Namba Yunus is very good at not engaging when she doesn't want to. And if I were trying to coach Zhang to win this one or bring herself into it, I would be talking about ringcraft, you know, trying to corner her and get off good low kicks when she can't just like dart back out of the way and make you miss and look like a mug. For Namba Yunus, I'd be saying keep it out in the center of the cage, move lots, do the bouncy stuff. I love the bouncy stuff. She does tend to come down off the balls of her feet as the fight progresses, which makes it even more impressive that Cyril Garn doesn't. but like if you watch the second Yun Jacek fight, I mean, it helped that Yun Jacek was landing good low kicks, but they were also more there towards the end of the fight because Namba Yunus was coming down off the balls of her feet and standing more. But then Namba Yunus in her rematch with Jessica Andrade, I wasn't even that impressed then, because that was one where everyone was like, well, she was dominating the first match up until she got you know, dumped on her head. And then the second match she did well, but she was still getting dinged quite a lot. I just don't know how much, like, Zhang's power is decent. I just don't know if she has that many tools. It's like the inside low kick and a good right hand. And a good double collar tie, like she'll abuse people from there because she's very, very strong. Be interested to see if she can use her wrestling. You know, she's always had a like equal number of submissions and knockouts. But any chance to watch Namba Yunus fight is great for me because like, she's one of my favorite. Well, she's easily my favorite women's MMA fighter, I think. And her style is really something that I think could be emulated well by male fighters. The bouncing in and out stuff is fantastic. Like if you watch her faking with her lead leg, where she bounces her lead hip towards the opponent and then back and then comes in for real, she's so quick at doing it. It's really good. And then she does a great little galloping step back as well. So her left foot comes back in underneath her and then her right foot kicks out behind her to retreat and she'll throw the overhand at the same time. She banged up Karolina Kowalkiewicz with that really nicely. But yeah, that'll be good. And then your Coco main event, which I think most people, I think this might be my favorite on the card, but Gaethje versus Chandler, you know, banger. I mean, guaranteed banger. And this is a triple run of fights where Trevor Whitman's in the corner for all three. You know, he's cornering Gaethje, Namba Yunus, and Usman. And that man, you know, I think he's most people's pick for Coach of the Year. Oh no, Eugene Behrman also had a really good year, but you know, he's a close, like, one of the most best regarded coaches in MMA right now. He's become sort of the spiritual figure that Greg Jackson was, maybe with a little bit of a better sense of humor about himself. But yeah, what he's been able to do with some of these guys. I mean, it took him a while with Namba Yunus and Gaethje, but Usman's been there for only a year or two, and he's coming along in leaps and bounds. He really has got like the gift for turning fighters, you know, decent strikers into good strikers. And he's got very interesting perspective on things. Like if you watch, well, his instructionals are great, but they're very long and I haven't got through either of them completely yet. But his first appearance on Rogan, I think it was, but he was just saying like, my job is to put people into positions where they consistently win exchanges and get out safely. And then it's just a case of them, you know, not, you know, if we do that enough, a knockout will come. If we do that enough and they've got good power, a knockout will come. You know, he doesn't consider it his job to make knockouts happen. He considers it his job to get his fighter to win exchanges and come out safe. And I think that's a really good way to look at it, especially when you've got someone like Justin Gaethje, because he, for a very long time, he has coached Justin Gaethje, I think since the beginning. But he said that Gaethje, like, for, you know, a lot of Gaethje's style was him wanting to be fun. And it was melting people. Like he was, that forward pressure is such a great way to finish top fighters. Top fighters don't get there by not being tough, you know? So if you've got the extreme other end of the scale, which is like Machida and Anderson not doing anything until you reach for them and then trying to counter you when you make a mistake, Gaethje's is the extreme opposite end of the spectrum, where you go forward and you make so much happen that the guy will make mistakes anyway, or get tired trying not to. But after the losses to Alvarez and Poirier, who both put on excellent performances in those fights, because both of those guys love a war too, and they managed to put together very technically sound, clever, savvy, tactical, strategic performances while also being in a bit of a dogfight. And those are the hard ones to do, because, you know, if he dings you and you go, well, now we're into it, you know, and you just start throwing back, then that's the game plan out the window. But both of them managed to do a good amount of hitting, take some hard blows, and the low kicks, which are going to be, you know, they're going to throw so many people off their game. If you're having a good round and you're doing great, and then he hammers you in the knee, and it feels like you've popped something out of place, and you want nothing more than to just sit down and go, oh, you know. But you have to continue working and also dancing around the cage to try and make the best of his sloppy footwork. But both did. But yeah, after those two losses, Gaethje really went back to the drawing board, or certainly started listening to Whitman more. Because, you know, you can't fight like that on the pads, because the guy is feeding you what you're meant to be doing. So he had all the technique, he just wasn't using it, probably. But since then, he's looked really good, except against Khabib, where he was just sort of like trying to push away and throw big swinging left hooks where he turned his body the entire way around. But again, that was Khabib using the same sort of strategy as early Gaethje, just overwhelm people. And he drew some mistakes out of Gaethje, and he got his takedowns and finished the fight. But and then after that, everyone's like, oh man, did Gaethje not know how to grapple on the ground at all? But I suppose we'll find out soon. Meanwhile, Chandler is, I would say, considerably less technical than Gaethje on the feet. You know, he's got a couple of moves he likes, right straight to the body. He's added like that shifting left hand, which he caught Henderson with. Right overhand, you know, it's the basic stuff. His jab is like, it's a big thudding jab, but it's not going to be an issue if you've got good counters and good awareness. As demonstrated by Pitbull, who within the first seconds of that fight got a read on his jab, slipped it and threw a right hand over the top. I think Chandler's just big power and big speed. And I think that really wavers as the fight goes on. I think it's going to be very interesting if he starts eating some of those low kicks because of his very long stance. And the other thing about Chandler is that, like, if you don't know Chandler, if you've not watched his Bellator career, a lot of his fights are try and kill the guy in the first round. After that, takedowns into closed guard and then just sort of push them to the fence. And if you land the odd elbow, that's great, but they're not going to get up. And I don't know how well that part of his game is going to work against world-class fighters in the UFC. However, I don't know how good Justin Gaethje is at getting up off his back, because he barely ever has to do it. I think this fight obviously favors Justin Gaethje the longer it goes. I think if Gaethje can pull out the sort of measured fights that he had against Vic and Cerrone and Barboza, that would be fantastic. You know, Barboza is a all-action guy. He's going to beat you up if you stand still too long. But I thought Gaethje did a very good job at keeping the range just right in that fight. And then any time that he stepped in, it was to attack and land. Any time that Edson Barboza wanted to step in and attack and land, he was out of the way or he was in on top of him. I think distancing is really his friend here. And I think that the hard part with Chandler is that because he's so quick, distancing is going to be very hard to get early on. You're going to have the dual factors of adjusting to his speed and also Chandler slowing down, because he really does slow down through fights. But yeah, he's a specimen, that Michael Chandler. I mean, they're both specimens, because Justin Gaethje's incredibly hard head and ridiculous punching power. But Chandler, like the speed of him, you know, Gaethje's decently fast, but if you watch Chandler just sprint across the cage winging right hands, it's kind of like prime Woodley when he wanted to go on offense. It's like that, but more aggressive. And he's speaking at like right wing ClamCon this next week or the week after. He's on the stage with like Charlie Kirk and a load of other just nutters. It was so weird being like, who are these fighters? Because I just saw Michael Chandler on the poster and I was like, interesting. But then I think when we're talking about Chandler generally, the thing that I always had with him was that it never really got beyond the base level athleticism stuff. I mean, he's added some bits and pieces, you know, the shifting through to Southpaw and stuff like that. But for the most part, like if you watch his fights with Eddie Alvarez, which, you know, he won the first and he almost won the second. But if you watch especially the second fight with Eddie Alvarez, Eddie's lancing him up with the jab and movement, because so much of Chandler's game is like whip his head back out of the way just as he sees something coming and then return with a big booming overhand or something like that. And it's so attribute based, you know, it's so based on his reactions and his speed and stuff that really wears down over the rounds. Even if you're an amazing physical specimen, you're not that same person in round five that you are in round one. And if you've got good technical striking and you're in condition, that, you know, there's not that much of a difference between your like round two self and round five self in terms of like, you know, punching speed and accuracy. And if you're making good practices in your striking, you know, you're moving your head after your strikes, your changing direction along the fence, things like that, you know, that stuff keeps you safe even when you are tired, which Chandler didn't have a lot of. And then there's, you know, so much of his game is in service of landing the one big shot. Like, you know, if you watch him against Hooker, basically he just sprints through on a left hand, wasn't it, along the fence. But if you watch him against Oliveira, it's still the same. Like, it's just one big punch after another, you know, just not really setting anything up in terms of, like, there's no combination work. The volume, the output is not that high. Basically, the setups he was trying against Charles Oliveira were like, throw the overhand right, then throw the right hand to the body, right hand to the body, and then right hand to the body, and either come up with the left hook or throw the overhand right again afterwards. You know, and it just meant that he was wide open for that left hook by Oliveira, which, you know, in fairness, was one of the most beautiful left hooks we've seen in MMA history, that particular left hook. But, you know, the counter left hook was a staple of Oliveira for a while because he loves pulling people into the clinch, the single collar tie, and elbowing their face off or kneeing them. But Justin Gaethje also has a wicked counter left hook. You know, you can watch him against Cerrone. You can watch it. Well, I mean, he didn't catch Habib with it, but you could see him taking Habib's head off a couple of times when he was pushing him off. And he turns all the way around and he walks off to his right when he throws the left hook, which is something that Whitman's taught him and shows in his instructionals and stuff. But it's a great way to just get massive power on a left hook and also to disengage afterwards, which is quite nice. The problem is, though, with counterpunching like that is that you're going to have to take the right hand at some point to throw it back. You know, to be close enough to throw the left hook, you have to be close enough to eat the right hand. And that's why, like, a high guard and trying to draw Chandler into punching the body might be a great shout here. But anyway, yeah, it's a fun fight. It'll be interesting. You know, what more can you ask for? So other stuff going on this weekend. We got just announced the retirement of Jean Valente. Oh no, you cry. No, God, like the saddest thing about this is that we won't ever see him get cut. But he could be pulling the Betch Kohea, which is where you go, oh yeah, well, I know I've lost five in a row, but I'm definitely retiring. This is my retirement fight. It would mean a lot to me if we did it in the UFC. But he's fighting Chris Barnett, and honestly, winnable for him, because Chris Barnett, while he's super athletic in one sense for a heavyweight, he's not athletic in the sense that he has any longevity. He will almost immediately gas after doing something cool that doesn't knock his opponent out. But then Jean Valente, he went up to heavyweight, and the assumption was like, well, he'll be quicker there at least, and he'll probably have a decent gas tank compared to some of these heavyweights. And then he tapped to exhaustion from the top against Maurice Greene. So, he's slotted into the heavyweight division quite nicely in the same sort of jobber role he had at middleweight or light heavyweight, wherever he was. But real fights, let's talk real fights. Frankie Edgar versus Marlon Vera, that's a fun one. Marlon Vera, a lot of his best stuff has been with the pressure. He's a very fun pressure fighter. Has that amazing, firstly, likes his front kicks to the body, his low kicks. But he has that amazing, I want to say pinch headlock, because that's the jiu-jitsu term. But, you know, in Muay Thai, you get like an underhook and you wrap your hands behind their head and you jam your head post in front of them. And you start kneeing. He does that well. Almost arm triangled a couple of people. I think it was Andre Yule. He almost arm triangled from that position. But yeah, just great clinch fighter, great clinch striker. One of the very few ones in the game. I think I name checked him in that Piotr Jan Filthy Casuals guide. On a good little run. It is a 2-2 run, but I felt he won the fight against Song Yudong, which wasn't even a split decision, which is even more annoying. But that he beat Sean O'Malley. But then I'm sure Sean O'Malley thinks he won that one. But then the Jose Aldo fight, he fought Jose Aldo, and it was just like, you know, you get in there with this old guy, and then you realize that he can do pretty much everything just about as well as you, or better. So Aldo's just checking his kicks and coming back with body shots. Basically, it looked like Aldo was sort of sparring and going like, oh, you could use some work here. But he gave a spirited effort, Vera, in that fight. And then Davy Grant, he just beat him. Davy Grant was on a good little run, had been knocking out some guys with some weird-ass neo footwork, which is now just classical footwork. It's Greco-Roman footwork. It's antiquity footwork. But Vera beat him, which is nice. Frankie Edgar on a little bit worse of a rundown. I mean, he did get the split decision win over Pedro Munhoz, but that was, in most people's eyes, a loss. But if that was a loss, that'd be four in a row, because Max Holloway beat him in a title fight, which he probably didn't deserve. Chan Sung Jung knocked him out in the first round, which is the one that I struggled to remember. Pedro Munhoz should have got the decision over him. And then Corey Sandhagen, in 30 seconds, jumped into a flying knee, and it looked like he ended his career, but he's back. I think one of the interesting things about this fight is that Edgar probably has the advantage in the clinch, you know, or rather when he enters the clinch to take the pressure off, he can just go for little duck in, double legs, single leg pickups, push him off if he doesn't like it. I feel like it's going to be hard to get pressure going on Frankie Edgar for Vera, who isn't like an enormous hitter. I wouldn't say he's got faster hands than Edgar. Well, I mean, Edgar's been slowing down, but like, I don't know if Vera's striking, like his kicking and punching, is scary enough that Edgar can't just circle around, tap him with the odd body shot to left hook upstairs, and then duck in on takedowns or clinches whenever he needs them. Vera from the bottom is, I mean, Vera's grappling is very fun. Like, if you watch him, he'll let go. Well, I say let. Guys shoot in on him and get his hips dead to rights. He'll take the overhook and he'll try and like step over on omoplatas on the way down, which isn't super high percentage in terms of defense, but it is something that most people don't have to deal with a lot of the time. And on the ground, he throws up triangles constantly, elbows well, you know, all the stuff you want. I just don't know if he can get up that easily against someone like Frankie Edgar. So Edgar, like, very long in the tooth, very past his best, but, you know, Vera's still, like, a top 15, top 20 guy. If he can beat him, that's impressive. But it's kind of like the Aldo fight, but now we know that Aldo was in a better state than Edgar was. It's a test of him, technically, against a truly great fighter who's maybe lost a step, or definitely lost a step. So I really like that fight. I think that's got something to tell us, which is nice. You know, I've sort of turned a corner from the Corey Sandhagen one, which was when I was like, oh my God, Frankie, please retire. But I could see him winning this. And if Vera wins this, you know, that's a big name on his record, which is something that he's been lacking. You know, Sean O'Malley's probably the biggest name he's got on his record at the moment. Before that, you've got Shane Burgos versus Billy Quarantillo. Shane Burgos is very frustrating because he's got a little bit of what Benson Henderson had, which is he'll have a great fight with anyone. And you're like, but there are people you shouldn't be having great fights with. There are people you should just be smoking. But it doesn't matter if it's Edson Barboza or, you know, Makwan Amikani. He'll somehow still fight them both like a life and death fight, even though those two fighters are levels apart. In fairness, Makwan Amikani gassing made that like the most decisive win of Burgos' recent career. Well, Christ, that's his last one. But, you know, that war against Emmett and then a war against Barboza, but got knocked out in that. It was a bit of a scary knockout because he got dinged and then it took him like 2 or 3 seconds to almost realize he'd been knocked down. But yeah, apparently fine. Brain scans, all that stuff. He's in good shape. Billy Quarantillo, bit of a step down from Emmett and Barboza. Certainly less dangerous on the feet. Billy Quarantillo mainly makes his stock and trade by his gas tank. Just going at 100 miles an hour from the beginning. But then, you know, Gavin Tucker got on him early and basically tired out Billy Quarantillo. So I don't know if, like, there's gas tank for working for five or three rounds at an amazing speed. But when you're doing it from the bottom and getting beaten up, it's even more tiring. So I think this is a nice one for, this should be a nice showcase for Burgos because he's got enormous talent. He's just got massive defensive liabilities because he's got good head movement. He's got good counter punches and stuff like that. It's just that he does sort of leave his chin out there on a platter sometimes. You know, for every, it's kind of like Joe Frazier, you know, like that you can make a highlight reel of Joe Frazier's defense where it's just wicked slips all the time. And you're like, damn, Joe Frazier must have been unhittable. And then you watch the actual fight and the slip comes between every punch. You know, like he gets hit and then he does a sick slip because he's moving his head, but he's just getting hit a lot too. Mason Jones had a bit of that the other day where he slipped some punches nicely and you're like, nice. And then he got dinged with something that he never should have got caught with. But for Burgos, I would love to see him adopt like a cross guard, you know, or just like one arm cross guard, folding guard, as they used to call it. You know, just use your forearms over your head and face, or even a high forearms guard, you know, just something. Because he hangs his chin out there and moves his head and comes back with lovely counter punches. You know, he times people well, but why not just have a bit of protection? And I really like the cross guard for MMA because you don't have the big gloves. But the other things that I thought like he should have been using more against Barboza, he has a great front kick to the body. He was annoying Barboza with that. Has a great low kick. He was out low kicking Edson Barboza at points in that fight, because low kicking, you know, is not about how hard you kick. It's about how you get the guy moving so that you can kick and he can't as easily. But, you know, I'm not going to count Billy Quarantino out because he's tough as nails. And I mean, as the Spike Carlisle fight showed, where he got like knocked out halfway through and kept going. But yeah, this is sort of a watershed moment on Burgos because he shouldn't be losing this fight. If you go like tooth and nail with Josh Emmett and Edson Barboza for most of the fight, you shouldn't be losing to Billy Quarantillo. I'm reading down this card and I was like, I've already done Justin Gaethje versus Michael Chandler, but in between recording, they've moved it down because obviously otherwise, as we pointed out, Trevor Whitman's doing three fights back to back to back. And it's hard enough when one of your guys gets knocked out early in the night. And you have to, or even wins by spectacular knockout, and you have to shake that off and focus on your next guy who's fighting. Andreas Michailidis, who I don't really know, but the reason that he's on this card is because he's fighting Alex Pereira. And Alex Pereira is a fucking specimen. I love Alex Pereira. He's probably the best, well, one of the best punchers in kickboxing history. Phenomenal power. And he always had it. Like, I remember doing things about Glory's Last Man Standing tournament back in the day when he was sort of like an alternate, I think he was, for the tournament. Or maybe he lost in the first round or something like that. But basically, everyone else in that tournament was a competent kickboxer already. It was guys like Joe Schilling, whose style really was more as like an anti-kickboxer, just lots of pokey teeps and weird stepping punches. But you had guys like Artem Levin, who, you know, absolute monster. And I think he beat Pereira in that tournament. But Pereira was a guy who'd come from boxing and had an awesome left hook, but not a lot else. And since then, he's come into his own. You know, he's knocking people out with flying knees. He's beating people up with low kicks. And the left hook is always still there. He has this very interesting thing that he was doing in his last fight, and does it in a lot of fights, but particularly in his last fight, you noticed it. He carries his guard very wide. Which, like, so if you imagine your hands are up in front of your shoulders, if you widen them a little bit so that you've got, like, a big window the opponent's throwing through, and that's a great way to sort of, like, pat punches down and parry them, but he'll do that so that the opponent throws, like, a right straight at him or a jab, and he will bring his left hand in from the side with, you know, just whip his shoulder in and get his elbow up so that his hand's coming in a left hook, and he can, like, properly mess people's worlds up with just that little punch. And he landed a couple of good ones in his last one. And then he sort of took the rest of the fight off, which was really weird. The whole thing with Glory lately has been really weird because Cedric Doumbé also made his successful MMA debut the other day. Wasn't super impressive, but, you know, I love Cedric Doumbé. But it's just weird because these guys are the best in the world at their sport. And they're going like, yep, no, still not getting paid enough. And Glory's sort of like giving them send-off fights. You know, Glory's having to be on the broadcast like, yes, this is a title fight. He will be leaving regardless to go and earn real money in MMA. It's just so weird. But the appeal is that he has a knockout win. Well, he has two wins, but one knockout win over Israel Adesanya. The first Adesanya fight, if you watch it, I felt that Adesanya won that fight. But you can't really argue that he won the one where he got knocked out. So, you know, it's a storyline built in to a division where there's only really Izzy and Rob, and no one else has an... Well, they had Vettori, you know, he won a round off Israel, so they could do the, you know, grudge match. But aside from that, there's not a lot going on in that division. So if they could somehow work out a way to get Alex Pereira to win enough, quickly enough, that they can throw him into a title shot, I imagine they will. But it is just such a hard game to come into halfway through. You know, Israel Adesanya, he had the two careers going on almost simultaneously. He was always working on the takedown defense and stuff and building his striking around that. You know, he was training, he was basically competing in kickboxing, and that was building his MMA game. Whereas with Pereira and Doumbé and all these guys, they're going to come across and they have to add to what they already have. You know, we've seen it with Gökhan Saki. He made some decisions, like you could see some of the things he was doing were different to what he usually does in the kickboxing ring, and he was fighting differently. Like he was using a lot more southpaw stance, throwing one shot at a time, not really combination punching. But yeah, it's like you're going like, well, what can I get away with using from my existing skill set, as opposed to building up the whole thing together? But his boxing's very good. He does a lot of great work with his knees and his left hooks, and I think that's always going to be an issue in the striking department in MMA, is just, can he stop a double? As Nick Diaz would say, can he stop a double? I just remember that Robin van Roosmalen, because they all do this, they all tease the crossover, and Robin van Roosmalen was supposed to be like Bellator's big get. He was going to be in their bantamweight tournament or whatever. First round, he realizes, he must have freaked out because he came in like 20 pounds overweight and he wanted the guy to take the fight. And the guy rightfully said no. And after shit in the bed like that, he's not fought since. So I have no idea what the idea is here. And van Roosmalen, people were like, excited about because he has a judo black belt, so they're like, yeah, well, that's basically, you know, that's basically takedowns done for. What else going on? Ally Aquinta is back, must need a small boost on something he's buying in real estate. You know, how do you follow the career of Ally Aquinta? Because he never fights, you know, he fights once every 2 years, but he's fighting Bobby Green, who will fight once every 2 days. Bobby Green, how's his run looking? Because I feel like he just had it broken, but he was doing really well through 2020-2021. Oh yeah, he lost the decision to Vasiev. Oh, he lost to Thiago Moises before that, which got Moises the number 15 ranking, but you know, that was a fight that I think a lot of people felt Bobby Green did enough to win. But Vasiev, the fight, you know, I thought that was really good. I thought that was a great showing from him. Striking against a very scary striker. You know, coming into that fight, everyone was like, well, you can't fuck around with Vasiev. And Bobby Green absolutely did. Meanwhile, Ally Aquinta is, you know, a good right hand, occasionally slips a punch. This is the one where if Bobby Green's jab is going to look amazing, it's going to look amazing here. You know, does a good takedown, stops a good takedown, tries the odd weird thing like a scissor leg takedown into heel hook. Very good grappler. Yeah, it's a fun fight. I hope Bobby Green wins so that we can stop doing like Ally Aquinta top 20 lightweight or whatever. But, you know, it goes on. Phil Hawes versus Chris Curtis, that's a weird fight. So Phil Hawes is coming off a win over Kyle Dorcus, and before that, Imavov, on a good little run, actually. 3-0 in the UFC, came in off the Contender Series off a knockout. But he's fighting Chris Curtis, and Chris Curtis, like, if you followed MMA for any time, you will have seen him. You just might not remember, but, like, if you see his face, you go, oh, yeah, that dude. He's been around forever. I think he's with Extreme Couture or someone like that. But he was on the Contender Series in, hold on, 2018. So June 2018, he won his fight in the first round by hook kick. And for some reason, he wasn't signed, which is really weird. I can't remember the ins and outs of that. But like he's then since then been like around the world doing weird shit. Turned up in PFL, lost twice to the same guy and then got knocked out by Ray Cooper. Millionaire Ray Cooper in the third appearance. Then he went back to Fight Night, ex-MMA. Like, he's just been doing weird local shows. But, yeah, it's just super weird that he has a fun style. He knocked out a guy in one round on the Contender Series, and they never got him in the UFC. And now he's coming at short notice because Darren Wynn was on this card. Darren Wynn has pulled out of this fight twice. First time due to rib injury, second time for no reason given. But, how is Darren Wynn still here? Well, he's DC's Gian Vellante. That's the answer to that. But yeah, this will be fun enough. I hope Chris Curtis wins one on the big stage. That'd be really nice. Edmund Shahbazyan is back against the aforementioned Imavov. Imavov just knocked out Ian Heinich. We talked about how weird his style is because he comes out very side on and looks like he's going to start throwing high kicks and then doesn't really kick very much at all, but does have a very nice jab. Edmund Shahbazyan smashed by Derek Brunson and then lost the decision to Jack Hermanson. Yeah, trying to get back on the horse, trying to get back on the hype train. He is Ronda Rousey's pet project, so he's probably got the Gian Vellante deal too. He's probably here forever. Jordan Williams versus Ian Garry. Ian Garry was pretty hot shit coming through Cage Warriors. There was a super weird thing in his last fight where his team apparently, like, he and his team split because he wanted his girlfriend in his corner or some shit like that. I can't remember who sent me that. It was someone involved in that. But very weird. But now he's with, I think, Sanford MMA because he was talking about training with Michael Chandler. Yeah, beat Jack Grant in his last fight in Cage Warriors. I've told you before, Jack Grant's legit. Beaten by decision. Basically finishes all up to that point. He's a fun guy. Got good striking. Got good grappling. Should be interesting. He's fighting Jordan Williams, who came in off the Contender Series and lost to Imavov and Mickey Gall. So, yeah, Imavov striker, Mickey Gall grappler. Basically, this should be winnable for Ian Garry. Basically, any way he wants. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. Mason Jones, we're all very hot on him, and he looked very middling in his last few once he got to the UFC. John Vellante versus Chris Barnett, we've already done. Dustin Jacoby's back against John Allen. Love a bit of Dustin Jacoby. Melsik Bagdasarian versus Bruno Souza. Okay. And then CJ Vergara versus Odie Osborne. Cool. There's some good stuff on that card. In fact, there's more good stuff than there is bad stuff. Well, I don't know, by weight. It depends how John Vellante's looking when he walks in. But anyway, that's a pretty good card. And then, just to finish this all off for today, we've got a Bellator going on this weekend as well. And they seem to be, like, putting a lot behind it. They're doing it on Friday or tomorrow. They're doing it tomorrow. And they're finally doing a fucking lightweight title fight because Patricio Pitbull hasn't defended it since Michael Chandler lost it to him the best part of 2 years ago. And basically, he's been holding out so that the Bellator brass give it to his brother. Because Patricio Pitbull is not great. Patricio Pitbull is very impressive. Patricio Pitbull has been so-so. Patricio Pitbull mainly turns up on other people's highlight reels. But most recently, he went to Ryzen as like their representative, their Bellator's representative. So he murdered the ghost of Tatsuya Kawajiri, beat Luis Gustavo, and then he fought Tofik Masayev, who's very legit in the tournament finals and got absolutely ragdolled. And then he came back to Bellator and fought Peter Queeley and lost by cuts. And Peter Queeley hasn't really done much himself except for this. And it was cuts by elbows from the bottom, which was fantastic. Patricio was furious in the corner afterwards. Peter Queeley is basically, Bellator. You know how if you join a gym, some of them give you like their own gi that says like the whatever gym or whatever force or whatever academy? SBG is like that, but when you sign up, you get a Bellator contract because they're just desperate to, Bellator are desperate to have like Conor McGregor adjacent people. They're trying to pick up whatever's left of the Irish MMA bandwagon. Because this card, in fact, firstly, it's in Dublin, but like Peter Queeley main event, James Gallagher co-main, Pedro Carvalho co-main. And there's guys like the 3-0 Kieran Clark on the prelims. But Queeley versus Pitbull, yeah, fun enough. Queeley on the ground, Pitbull standing, probably. Mix versus Gallagher is interesting because they're both shit hot on the ground. Never been too impressed by Gallagher on the feet. Or Mix, actually. And then Daniel Wychel versus Pedro Carvalho. Pedro Carvalho is a ton of fun because he's just constant forward pressure. But his fight with Patricio was completely surreal because Patricio is half his size. And he's trying to walk him down, and then Patricio just keeps banging him out. Like, just keeps hitting him with big punches and knocking him down. But he's coming off a loss to JJ Wilson as well. So he's on a two loss streak, Pedro Carvalho. Bit of a shame. Anyway, yeah, it's not great, this card, but it is probably worth checking out what happens in it. James Gallagher, despite being an obnoxious Conor McGregor ripoff, is very talented. Patchy Mix is also very talented. And Queeley and Pitbull had a fun first fight, so they'll probably have a fun second fight. And you've also got Gökhan Sarıkam, who is not related to Gökhan Saki, except for name and Turkishness. So watch out for him. Right, I reckon that'll do us for today. There's a lot going on this weekend. I'm looking forward to watching all of it. I'm still playing around trying to get this streaming thing going. Unfortunately, my TV broke yesterday, so I'm going to try and get a new one ordered from Jean-Louis in time, get the warranty, which I will then lose and forget about. But if I can get my TV sorted and then have my computer set up next to it and ready to stream, I might do something. At some point in the future, I will do a slacky, sneaky stream, which I will only upload, I'll only tell the patrons about. But I've got to work out how to do it first. And if I can get it done this weekend, that'd be awesome. But If not, it'll be some other time when my wife's not around and I have the weekend to watch fights. So I can't promise it'll be really soon. Anyway, you know where to find all my shit. I'm your boy Jack Slack, and I will catch you on Monday after this banging card and the UFC card as well. Cheers.